Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Kudzu Killers, Homicide, and Sweet Tea. Hope you're having a great Christmas week or whatever holiday you celebrate. You have any plans for Christmas, Lark?
Sort of. I had some special made things for Jody and me and his family and my mom. And I can say it now because by the time they hear this, they won't know. I had some special signs for outside our houses that have our names engraved and whatnot. So I thought that was very cool.
They finally got there?
They got here. Today, I saw the postman at 6 o'clock this morning deliver them. So
cool.
Yay.
Good. They finally found my aunt's package that's been mailed for 3 weeks and still here in Dallas. And so hopefully it's off on its way to where it needs to go. And we'll get there before Christmas, I hope.
Let's hope so. So we're going to all have roast beast and sing Who songs, I suppose.
We're just going to have a quiet Christmas at home and open the 12,000 presents that are stuffed under the tree.
So. Oh my gosh. Well, I know who those presents are for.
Yeah, I'm sure. Most of them. Anyway.
She's not rotten or anything.
No, not at all. I did want to mention this is kind of a pet project of mine, and it's been adopted as Kudzu Killer's holiday project this year, and that's food banks. If you can spare a few dollars, please consider donating to your local food bank. Times have been rough this year, and some kids and elderly folks are going to go to bed without a good hot meal. And just donate anything non-perishable like canned veggies or rice, beans, boxes of mac and cheese, whatever you can spare. They'd all be greatly appreciated. Even pancake mix, syrup, those kinds of things that have a long shelf life. And don't forget some pet food if you can, because these folks have pets and times are tough. It's tough for everybody. You know, they're making a choice to feed their babies and maybe not feed themselves. So let's give them a helping hand if you can. And if you feel blessed and feel like you're doing well this year, despite what's going on, please consider donating. And don't forget your local animal shelters as well, because they can always use bags of food and blankets and collars and whatever you can spare. Now, speaking of animals, Lark, but not the good kind.
not the fuzzy kind. Okay. All right.
Not the fuzzy kind. Well, I don't know. But anyway, this week we're going to talk about the Zodiac Killer.
Ooh.
Because I've been wanting to do an episode on this guy for a long time, and we kind of went a different direction, and we didn't do folks outside the South so much. And he was so well known, and everybody's done him to death. But in light of the new developments in the case this last week or so, we kind of felt like it might be the perfect time to talk about the Zodiac Killer.
Exactly. And get y'all's feedback, too. So I know Kim has her thoughts and theories, and she's going to give us an awesome story, no doubt.
We'll see.
I have every faith in you. I'm sure. I know.
Now, this guy, as you probably know, because you've heard about him a lot, has never been found, but we might be getting closer to that identity as the last of the cryptograms, or ciphers, as they like to call them, was evidently solved recently by a team composed of a Belgian, an American, and an Australian.
That's so exciting!
But we'll get to that a little bit later.
Oh, gosh. And okay, fine.
First, we're going to go back over the case that's baffled detectives and basically the world for the last 50-plus years.
Okay, cool.
Now, on the night of December 20th, 1968, in Vallejo, California, David Faraday, 17, and Betty Lou Jensen, 16, were on their first date. They'd met a couple weeks before, and their evening consisted of David meeting Betty Lou's parents, which everybody did back then.
Yeah.
If you were good folk.
Mm-hmm.
They made a stop at a friend's house and went to a Christmas concert at Vallejo's Hogan High, where Betty went to school.
Mm-hmm.
David was an Eagle Scout. And Betty Lou was a Grand Royal Guide for the Pythian Sunshine Girls, which was a branch off of a women's service organization called Pythian Women or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these were pretty good kids out for a night having fun.
Right.
They were on their way home from the concert when they decided to park at a private spot off Lake Herman Road to presumably do a little necking, probably, I'm guessing, before they headed home for their 11 p.m. curfews.
Mm-hmm.
Later that evening, a woman by the name of Stella Medeiros found their lifeless bodies outside their car and raced toward the police station in Vallejo. Or actually, it was Benicio, I think. honking and flashing her lights at a police car until she was able to get them to pull over.
Oh, good.
Then a call into the station brought Detective Pierre Bidou, who found David lying outside his car, a gunshot wound above his left ear. He was still breathing when he got there, but he didn't make it to the hospital. Betty Lou was found about 28 feet away from David's station wagon, and she'd been shot 5 times in the back and twice in the chest. The bullet casings that were found nearby were a Winchester Super X, and I'm familiar with those. I don't know if you are familiar with that type of stuff.
Oh, I'm not a big gun girl. Although I own a gun, I am going to tell y'all. So it's Texas. Take it or leave it.
It's the kind that are used in 22 rifles. That's what I learned how to shoot on, and 22 pistols. I learned how to shoot on those, but they're small bullets. Mm-hmm. And the detectives always thought this case might have been about drugs because the rumors had gone around that David had overheard somebody talking about a big drug deal and he'd been opening his mouth when he shouldn't have and stuff like that. But in 1969, we would find out the truth about their deaths. That 4th of July in 1969, Michael Renaud Magou, or Majou, 19, and Darlene Elizabeth Farron, 22, decided to go park and, quotation marks, talk at Blue Rock Springs Park on the outskirts of Vallejo. Darlene was a waitress, and she was on her second marriage at 22. But, you know, those things happen. And Michael was listed as a laborer. I don't know what kind of laborer, if he worked on the farms around there or what he did. But at some point around midnight, a man drove up to where they were parked in a light brown car, possibly a Mustang or a Corvair, and parked near them. He got out of the car and approached their vehicle without saying a word and began shooting.
Wow.
He shot Darlene 3 times and Michael 2 times. And when he turned and started walking back to his car, Michael screamed out in pain. And he turned back around and shot them both twice more.
Oh, wow.
So that was a total of 5 times for Darlene, 4 times for Michael. Darlene died at the scene, but Michael survived.
Oh, wow.
The incident was called into Vallejo Police Department, and the police were dispatched at 12:10 a.m. I watched a little video with a little lady who was the dispatcher back then. She told that she took the call at 12:10 a.m. and dispatched right away. Michael gave them a good description of the shooter. Then about 45 minutes later, the dispatch got another call. This one was from a man claiming responsibility for the attacks. He told this little old lady he wanted to report a double homicide because he thought he'd killed them both. He told her that he'd used a 9mm to shoot them, which was correct. They knew that. They found some casings. And then he claimed responsibility for the murders of Faraday and Jensen. That's the two that died 7 months earlier on December 20th.
Wow.
Up until then, you know, they thought it was the drug deal gone wrong, or not the drug deal gone wrong, but that he knew too much about a drug deal. But now they knew that the same person killed them as well.
So he wants them to know.
He wanted them to know it was him. Michael wasn't dead, like I said, so he was able to give a description of the guy. He said he was 5'8 to 5'9, white, late 20s to early 30s, with a stocky build and brown hair. Michael said the man never uttered a word to them, just walked up and started shooting. And both Darlene's ex-husband and her current husband, Dean, were suspects briefly, but they both had alibis. So they didn't know who might have done this or why, because both of their leads dried up. They were dead ends. A few weeks later, on July 31st, both the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner newspapers, you know what those things are? They're those things that are made out of paper and they fold up and they have black print on them.
And your grandma used to cut out
people
when
actually
you
read them.
You were in it. Take that little article.
Your grandma cut your picture.
Put it in your scrapbook.
Yeah. Yeah, they folded up and they had advertisements in them. But anyway, they had the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner, as well as the Vallejo Times Herald, each got 1/3 of a cryptogram that the writer claimed would identify him once they solved it. The cryptogram, or cipher as they like to call them, was called Z408 because there were 136 symbols in each of the three letters, which added up to 408 symbols. So they had 408 just to have a way to keep track with them. The writer told them all in identical letters that if they did not, each one of them, publish it in their newspaper on Friday, August the 1st, he would go on a killing rampage that weekend and wouldn't stop until he'd killed a dozen people.
Wow.
So they did. And within about a week, North Salinas, I don't know if you know where Salinas is. It's the kind of central coast. It's kind of farming community. That's where school teacher Donald Hardin and his wife, Betty, contacted the San Francisco Chronicle with their solution to the ciphers. Betty discovered two what they call cribs, or which is words or phrases that are repeated so that you can try to figure out what they're saying. And those helped fill in some spots throughout the message and helped them start decoding by recognizing patterns. I don't know if you've ever done a cryptogram. I hate them. They're hard.
Yeah,
it's where it's just got combinations of letters or symbols, and you have to kind of figure out what each symbol, what letter they stand for, and then you can fill in the blanks and figure out what it's saying.
Girl, I hate crosswords, so don't even go there with me. I'm sure this would not be my thing.
No, my mom used to do them all the time, but I just never got into them. They're hard.
No, not my thing.
They're much harder than a crossword.
Well, I hate that stuff, so I'm not into games. Kim loves games. I don't like games, but go ahead.
So they started recognizing patterns, and Betty guessed that the message would start with an I because she felt like the guy was kind of self-centered, so she figured the first symbol would stand for I.
Makes sense.
Then they noted some double letter patterns, and the most used double letters are L and T. So she thought he'd have something about killing in it, so she filled in, you know, letters, any double symbols, she'd fill in with two L's and an I.
Mm-hmm.
And her guesses were all correct. And so they started unraveling the code and finally got it unraveled. And what it said was, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It's more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and all the blank, it doesn't say, probably victims or people I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife." That's kind of creepy.
Yeah, kind of creepy.
Yeah. Just
lots creepy.
Just a little bit. And he started using the symbol circle with the cross in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the police thought that was probably crosshairs, like on a sight for a gun.
That's what I always thought. I mean, I never...
I don't think it was. I think we're gonna talk about that in a little bit. But we're going to take a break now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the other murders that we know of. And, you know, some possible suspects.
Yay!
And whom I think is the most likely suspect. And the update on the fourth cipher. And
awesome!
Yeah. So we'll be back in just a few. Okay, thanks for coming back, y'all. Nearly 2 months later, on September 27th, Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd were enjoying a day at Lake Berryessa near Napa. At about 6:15 p.m., Cecilia noticed a man approaching them wearing an unusual costume. I'm sure you've all have seen drawings of this unusual costume. He had on a black vest with the zodiac symbol on it, a big hood thing over his head. You've seen that picture, I'm sure. And he was holding a gun. He was described as being around 5'10 and weighing at least 170 with greasy brown hair. The description is similar to what Michael Mayhew saw or described.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they saw the greasy brown hair with the hood on, but there were three women who were walking in the nearby town who saw the strange man walking around about the time of the attack. So they probably got that kind of description from them as well. Now, right. Brian thought it was a robbery. So he tried to give the guy his keys to his car and his wallet, but the guy wouldn't take them. Instead, he had Cecilia tie Brian up with plastic clothesline. And then the man tied her up. Then he went over to Brian and began stabbing him in the back 6 times. Went over to Cecilia and stabbed her 5 times in the front and 5 times in the back. They started screaming when he left, and a fisherman found them and alerted park rangers. But this location was so remote that it took nearly an hour for the ambulance to arrive.
Oh, wow.
At which time, both victims were in critical condition. Now, just over an hour after the attacks, Napa Police Department got a call from a guy claiming responsibility for the stabbings, and they traced that call to a phone booth in downtown Napa. And that's where the people saw him. The three women saw him, or saw a guy walking around. And they discovered when they got to the victims that the attacker had written a message on Brian's car door. The message said the dates of the Faraday Jensen murders and the Farron Majot attacks and was signed with a cross circle symbol.
Oh, my.
Tire tracks indicated that the killer parked behind Brian's car, and footprints they found outside that area talked about a size 10.5 wing walker shoe. And that's a military type of boot, a wing walker is. And the impressions there indicated that he weighed more than 200 pounds.
Not 170.
Guy, he was not 170, but they said at least 170. So, you know, in that situation, you know, with shock and whatever, they might not have been able to recall exactly or,
true,
you know.
Yeah,
true. Or they might not have known. I mean, I don't really know what 170 versus 200 pounds looks like, to be honest. I know they're, that 170 is probably on the chubby side for that height, and 210 is probably on the fat side. But, you know, I don't know if I were given the chance, I would be able to tell you exactly how much they weigh. So they're going on the idea that this is the same guy since he listed all the other things on the car.
Makes sense.
Now, Cecilia died about 48 hours later, but Brian recovered.
Oh.
And he's now a lawyer somewhere, or he was, you know, in this article that I read, he was a lawyer. So he survived.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The last known victim was just a couple weeks later on October 11th, and it was taxi driver Paul Stein. His cab was hailed at Mason and Geary Streets. I don't know how familiar you are with San Francisco, but I kind of know where that is.
I do too.
The intended destination was supposedly Washington and Maple Streets near the Presidio. Because I guess they call in where they're going when they pick up a fare, right?
Right.
The cab ended up in Washington and Cherry Streets, just a block away from where the person was picked up on Mason and Geary. And Stein's wallet and keys had been taken, and a chunk had been cut out of his shirt.
Oh.
There were bloody fingerprints, possibly of the suspect, and a pair of size 7 black leather gloves were found in the cab that didn't belong to the victim. There were 3 witnesses to this murder who called the police and described a white male, 25 to 30 years old, 5'8 to 5'9, with a stocky build, sounding familiar, with a stocky build, reddish brown hair worn in a crew cut, heavy rimmed glasses, and dark clothing, which is more like Michael's description, pretty much the same.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the police dispatcher called it out as a black male. Instead of a male wearing black, he said a black male.
Oh,
so when two patrol officers, Donald Fuch and Eric Zelms, crossed paths with a white guy near that area, they didn't stop him because it had been called out as a black male and this guy was white.
Oh, no.
But their description of that guy they ran across was pretty much the same as the other descriptions. Around 5'10". Between 180 and 200 pounds, barrel-chested, with light-colored crew-cut hair and wearing glasses.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. The man didn't appear to be carrying anything with him, and there was no conversation between him and the officers at all, according to them. But, you know, the guy that got away.
Wow.
The Stein murder was initially thought to be a cabbie killing, you know, a robbery gone bad, somebody trying to get his money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But on October 13th, 1969, the San Francisco Chronicle received another letter from the Zodiac, and it contained that chunk of the cabbie's bloody shirt. Mm-mm-mm. And he took credit for the killing. So he's confessed to that killing as well. San Francisco Police Department inspectors David Tashi and Bill Armstrong were assigned to the case, and they were shocked when they figured out that that piece of shirt belonged to Stein. But from the witness descriptions, from those three witness descriptions, they were able to create a composite sketch of the killer to kind of see what he looked like. I'm sure everyone's seen that, but we'll be including, that'll be in our audiogram for this episode. Despite evidence mounting up and them getting more and more information like fingerprints and footprints and tire tracks and everything like that, they still weren't able to catch him.
That's just incredible.
Yeah. So he remained at large. Well, he remains at large today if he's alive, but this has been so long ago. I have my doubts. I don't think he is.
Yeah, he could be definitely dead, or he's pretty elderly at this point.
Right. Well, they had a lot of suspects and narrowed down to three likely suspects. The first one is Earl Van Best Jr. I don't know if you've heard about The Most Dangerous Animal of All. It's a FX documentary that Gary Stewart wrote a book. He's an adopted person, and he went in search of his biological parents, and he finally figured out that his biological father was Earl Van Best Jr., and he became convinced that he was the Zodiac.
Oh, yeah. I did see that. It was very interesting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do.
Now, there's almost no evidence that really ties him to the murders, although he did have a really lengthy criminal history, including rape and drunk driving and fraud and pedophilia.
Yeah.
But it seems like if he was into rape, he would have taken advantage of those girls in that situation, you know? But
yeah,
I would think he would have taken advantage of that before he killed them if he was a rapist, as this guy seems to have been.
I would also think that if he was a rapist, why would he come on to a couple's?
Right. Well, there are others. There are other supposed victims that weren't couples, but there was also no rape with those either. So I don't think it was this guy, even though he really, really, really looked like that composite sketch. I mean, really, you know, overlay the sketch with a photograph of him and they look very, very much alike.
That would pretty much creep you out if you thought your dad was a serial killer.
Yeah. If you thought your biological father was a serial killer. Yeah. I'd be scared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, he died in 1984 in Mexico. So we'll never really know for sure. But like I said, he did bear a striking resemblance to that police sketch.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if I were a betting girl, I might bet on him.
Yeah.
The other suspect was Louis Myers. A man named Randall Kennedy came forward in 2014 and claimed that his best friend named Louis Myers had confessed to being the killer before his death in 2002 when he was diagnosed with terminal cirrhosis of the liver.
Mm.
Kennedy claimed that the circle and cross symbol were not crosshairs of a gun, as police had at one time thought, but instead the symbol was that of a Celtic cross. Kennedy said Myers was obsessed with his Scottish heritage, and that's the real reason he chose that symbol.
Interesting.
But Myers was younger than what the victims and witnesses described. Of course, that's always possible. People sometimes look a lot older than they are. But he would have been in his teens when these murders happened, and they all described, you know, late 20s to 30.
Right, right.
Now, there was a Halloween card. I mean, Zodiac communicated a lot with the police and with these newspapers. And he would send them cards and he would send them different things with information in them. He sent other ciphers. Some were really short, like only 13 symbols or something like that. And this guy, Kennedy, claims that the Halloween card that they received as a part of those pieces of correspondence with the words in it, "look for a teen," meant to look for a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Not looking for the number 13 or 14, as investigators thought, as far as the number of victims goes.
Oh, okay.
And certain events in Myers' history matched up with those connected to the Zodiac, but there was never any conclusive proof. And of course, he's dead now. He's been dead for nearly 20 years. So,
yeah.
And the last one, and probably the most likely, was Arthur Lee Allen. And I don't know if have you seen The Zodiac, the movie with Mark Ruffalo and Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was adapted from a book by a former San Francisco Chronicle cartoonist, Robert Gray Smith, who was around at the time that all this information was coming in, when the killings were taking place and all this information was being sent to San Francisco Chronicle and all the ciphers and everything.
Wow,
and he became kind of obsessed with the case. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote two separate books on it, the 1986 Zodiac, which the movie was based on, and 2002 Zodiac Unmasked, in which he claims that the man was Arthur Lee Allen, or as he was known, sometimes Lee Allen, was mm-hmm. the most likely suspect. Allen died in 1992, and it was never conclusively connected to any of the murders, but he wore the same size boots as the prints found at the scene. He wore a watch bearing that symbol of the circle with the crosshairs.
Interesting.
And he had a lot of personality characteristics in common with serial killers, like being quiet, standoffish, a pedophile. And also one of those short ciphers I was telling you about, someone claimed at one point to have solved one of the short ones that was only 13 symbols long and made it out to say, "I am Lee Allen."
Oh, interesting.
So in 1991, the Vallejo Police Department finally got around. How many years is that?
Oh, my goodness.
20-something years after the fact. Showing Mike Mageau a photo array. So, you know, like six photographs of possible suspects lined up, and they show it to you. That's what a photo array is.
Mm-hmm.
And he identified Arthur Lee Allen as being the person who shot him.
Wow.
When they asked him why he'd never identified Allen in the last 20 years, Mageau said that he had never been shown any pictures of suspects, and he had only been asked if he recognized any names, and he didn't.
Oh, my gosh.
Because he didn't know the guy's name. That's quite a big blunder right there by the police, I hate to say. So, I think the conclusion is, even though they are breaking these ciphers and they finally broke the last one, which is what I'm going to talk about in a minute, I don't think we'll ever know who did it. I really don't, for sure.
Right.
Unless they can get some DNA somewhere and do some kind of advanced DNA testing, I don't think we will. Maybe they can use the little vac, wet vac.
Yeah.
But anyway, as I mentioned at the beginning of today's episode, on December 11th of this year, so just a couple weeks ago, it was announced that after more than 50 years, amateur code breakers had solved the Zodiac Killer's cipher, the fourth one. It was three computer programmers from three different countries, Jarl van Eyck from Belgium, David Orenchak from the U.S., and Sam Blake from Australia. And they worked together online to solve what's known as the Zodiac's 340 cipher. And it's called that because it had 340 characters.
Wow.
Without going into a ton of detail, because it can be really boring detail to me anyway, because it's all computer stuff and I'm not a computer person.
Yeah, it's boring.
Orenchak and Blake went through about 650,000 variations on a software that was developed by van Eyck called AZ Decrypt, as well as another program called ZK Decrypto, and studied all the permutations that they made.
Interesting.
Orenchak described it as not just finding a needle in a haystack, but having to find the right haystack to look in for the needle.
Oh, wow.
So according to Orenchak, the reason this cryptogram was so difficult to solve and has taken so many years is because the Zodiac constructed it in a completely different way than he did the others. So van Eyck was able to put together the pieces and discover a couple of mistakes made by the Zodiac in its construction and rearranged it, and then they had their solution. And the decoded message read, "I hope you are having lots of fun and trying to catch me. That wasn't me on the TV show, which brings up a point about me. I am not afraid of the gas chamber because it will send me to paradise all the sooner, because I now have enough slaves to work for me where everyone else has nothing when they reach paradise. So they are afraid of death. I am not afraid because I know that my new life is life, will be an easy one in paradise death." There's some iffy things there to me, but, you know, like the spelling of paradise is different than it was in the other cipher that the couple solved.
Right.
It's got a C in place of the S in paradise.
Right.
And there's a little bit of garbled language there, but, you know, kind of sounds like the guy would things he would say. But and the FBI has confirmed that it's most likely the right transcription of it. But I guess it'll remain to be seen. And maybe they can do some kind of, if this guy was smart enough to do all this stuff and create all these ciphers, he was probably smart enough not to lick the envelope, although DNA wasn't talked about much back then. If he was that smart, he might have known about it and might have known that he could leave some behind. And I personally, everybody used those little, do you remember those little tubes with water in it and had a sponge on the end of it? And you just used that to wet your envelopes when you did Christmas cards?
Yeah, you just used a squeaky, you know, sponge. You got it wet and then you go.
We used that thing for green stamps. My mom would fill it up and I'd sit there and swipe that all across the green stamps and stick them in the booklet, you know?
Exactly.
So if he was smart, he used something like that and not lick the envelopes. But, you know, that remains to be seen. I guess we'll be getting some more updates in the future, but maybe they can use, like I said, maybe they can use that little vacuum, that wet vac, and vacuum up some stuff from that shirt or whatever, and we can find out. But at this point, I'm thinking it's kind of a moot point.
Well, it is, but it is something that, you know, everybody wants to, you want to solve.
I'm sure the survivors of the attacks would really like to know who attacked them.
Well, I'm sure that the survivors would, but also just like we want to know who Jack the Ripper was. I mean, it's just become sort of a legend and we want to know. I just always wondered on those cipher things, why couldn't she put all those little things into a computer and have it come out to...
Well, you kind of have to have a program that'll do that. Something has to tell the computer what to look for. They're not as smart as we'd like to think. They're not going to take over the world anytime soon, although they can shut off a power grid.
True.
And make everything dark. But
turn my electricity off.
But as far as solving things like this, you kind of have to tell them what to look for and what to do. And once these guys got this software developed, once Van Eyck got this decryptor software developed, they were able to plug it in and it just runs. It just runs all the, you've seen those things in movies that really weren't realistic back then, where they were trying to get a password to get into something and it would just be running all these numbers and then it would stop on one.
Yeah.
Those weren't real back then, but they're getting closer to real now and are real, I think, in some instances for some things. But they needed to do that for these codes, for these characters and these ciphers. And they were finally, like I said, 650,000, and they had to go through those one at a time, I guess, to rule out which ones weren't real. And they've been working on this for a while online together, three different countries. I think that's so cool. Three different computer guys in three different countries got together to work on this and try to crack the code. And
it really is pretty incredible.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, awesome.
Tell us what you guys think.
Yeah. I mean, I know this has been a hot thing that's just recently come out, and some people are like, eh, I'm over it. And other people are like, this is so cool. I personally think it's kind of cool.
I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, did you know, have you seen Dirty Harry?
Yeah.
You know? Did you know that was partially based on the Zodiac? Because there's a scene in it that involves a school bus full of children being hijacked. And one thing in one of the letters that Zodiac sent said he was going to look for a school bus and he was going to, I guess he was going to tell them about it, that there was a problem or a bomb on or something like that, and pick the little kiddies off one at a time as they got off the bus.
Oh, my.
Something like that. I don't remember the exact thing that he said, but there was something to that effect in Dirty Harry.
Wow, and in steps Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Make my day.
Yeah, man.
But if you haven't seen Zodiac... If you haven't seen the movie by David Fincher called Zodiac, you should. It's an all-star cast, and it's really, really good, and it kind of goes over the whole story and how it started to kind of destroy these police officers and these reporters' lives because they became so obsessed with it, and they worked so hard to try to find the guy, especially the ones in San Francisco, that they, you know, kind of lost family, lost touch with people and things like that, so... Give it a watch if you haven't already.
Well, you know, I mean, how can you really go wrong with Jake Gyllenhaal and...
Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. especially.
Yes!
Yeah.
Oh, Yes, 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 yes. Oh, anyway. So that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was fun to research. Of course, I knew some of it already, but I really got a little more information on each of the killings than I had ever known before or had heard before. So, And I especially like to look into the lives of the victims because, you know, these are usually pretty good, pretty decent people that just step in the path of the wrong person. And that's what happened to these folks.
Right.
And there are others that they think might belong to him. And there's a website called ZodiacKiller.com that has all of the possible victims and all of the victims that they have figured out weren't his listed on there.
Wow.
So, you know, if you're interested and you want to see some of the other possible victims that were never actually tied in but might be possible victims,
I think I would be curious to talk to the guy who survived. That would be kind of interesting. I wonder what his personality is like. Is he humble? Is he full of ego? I didn't die from this person. You know what I mean?
I don't think either one of them are like that. Like I said, Brian is now a lawyer in the Bay Area.
Right.
Or I'm supposing he may be retired by now, but he became a lawyer. And at first he would talk about it. He would go on the media and talk about it or talk to reporters or book writers about it. But then after a little while, he just stopped. He said, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to think about it anymore. Don't bug me anymore. I don't want to have anything to do with it.
I can see that. Yeah. I mean, I can see wanting to talk about it for a while and then you're done. I'm done. It's just like, you know, going through a divorce. You talk about it for a long time and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm just sick of talking about that. Yeah, I'm done. I don't need to talk about it either. So, well, good for them. At least they got away.
Michael Mageau has talked about it a little bit too, but and like I said, back in 1991, he said, that's the guy talking about Lee Allen. So they should have talked to him. They should have shown him some pictures earlier. Show some pictures, people. He didn't know this guy. You know, they always thought that he knew him, I think, maybe. But he didn't know this guy. And so when they gave him names, he didn't have a clue who that was that they were talking about. So they should have shown him pictures right off the bat. And
I would think if they showed him pictures and then, you know, the police didn't catch the guy and it really was the guy, that it would bother me that, hey, you know, y'all didn't listen to me and I had the information and that would be weighing on my heart, I think. Not that he had anything to do with it, but, you know, it would just weigh on you a little bit. It is a classic.
It was a classic. It's Classics Week on Kudzu Killers.
Yeah, it's a classic. We're trying to fill in with some other weird stuff that y'all may or may not have ever heard before. And, you know, just to keep you surprised, keep you guessing.
All right, then. Well, y'all have a good Christmas. Have a joyful holiday if you're doing Hanukkah, if you're doing Kwanzaa, whatever you're doing out there. Have a good one and keep listening.
Y'all love your people and hug the ones you can and don't bury the bodies without us.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.
That's our episode for this week. Thanks for listening to us and we hope you join us again every Tuesday for an exciting new episode.
Head on over to our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com and leave a comment or your ideas about the subject this week.
Or follow us on Twitter at kudzukillerspod and you can shout out to us anytime or send a question for our next Q&A.
Yes, ma'am. And we'd love you forever if you leave us a review on whatever podcast blows you scared at. We'd love to hear what you think of our new show.
If you'd like to become a part of the Kudzu Killers family, hop on over to patreon.com/kudzukillerspodcast and take a look at the goodies you get when you show us some love.
That's right. And if you love our music, check out Jody Jennings Music on Facebook, SoundCloud, or all social media and streaming music platforms.
So until next week,
or if we decide to shoot out a mini episode,
bye y'all.
Bye, y'all.